In recent years, the U.S. and the Taliban were negotiating and agreed that the U.S. reduces drone attacks, and that is why we witnessed a decrease in casualties during these two wars. This does not mean the Americans value human rights or have reduced errors and miscalculations in their operations. Drawing a comparison between these two years can't simply be a positive point for the Pentagon.
The exact number of casualties during the 20 years of the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan is unknown, but the statistics show a 330% increase in the figure since 2017, when the U.S. military relaxed its rules of engagement for airstrikes in Afghanistan. Another source estimates more than 1,000 civilians have lost their lives in air raids, but that only includes the death toll from 2015 to 2020, which accounts for only 5 years of the U.S. presence. The survivors of U.S. attacks never received proper compensation, and no American troops were duly tried for their wrongdoings in Afghanistan. The reason, as stated most of the time, was that the investigations never found any violation of the law. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
The moment when, via live link from a neighboring room, the Electoral Committee of Donetsk People's Republic announced to the press their intention to join Russia.
Colleagues, on the question raised for the referendum, do you support Donetsk People's Republic entering the Russian Federation by the rights of its subject is considered to be confirmed? I ask you to sign the protocol. It's a historical signature. I congratulate you.
These are historical days now. We are reuniting with our big motherland, Great Russia. Now we can breathe out, take a break for half a day, and continue creating, building, and repairing. But now we are not going to do it alone. Our brothers, our friends are with us now. I would like to thank every Donbass citizen. You are heroes.
Meanwhile, NATO countries have dismissed the votes as a sham. They say they are illegal under Ukrainian and international law. I put this question to Denis Pushilin moments after the result was made official.
Ukraine and NATO countries call this referendum illegitimate, and Russia is the only country so far to say that this referendum is legitimate. What do you have to say to those critics?
You know, once there was a time when Western countries didn't recognize the USSR. Our way is defined. The Western point of view was expected. Of course, we'll take into account their opinion, but we'll now act following the interests of our mother Russia.
Regardless of whether the West sees these referendums as legitimate or not, in the coming days, Russia will announce that these regions are now part of the Russian Federation, ushering in a new stage in the Russia-Ukraine war. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
The World Bank, in its latest report on Afghanistan, has said that global food and energy prices continue to put pressure on basic household prices in the crisis-stricken country. At the same time, rising inflation and slow recovery in nominal wages have decreased the people's ability to buy basic goods.
Today, we witness people have lesser purchasing power. Previously, a middle-class household used to pay nearly $200 to buy multiple goods, but today they only ask for very basic necessities like oil and flour. You know, the prices are increasing. In addition, the banking crisis and sanctions have affected the prices and business in the market.
The World Bank report has confirmed that since June 2022, Afghanistan's currency has depreciated slightly against the U.S. dollar, while the prices of basic food and fuel items continue the upward trend. Abdullah Rizayi, who has been working as a shoemaker for almost half of his life, says he had never experienced such economic conditions before.
In the past years, I used to make sufficient income from this job. Currently, I'm not only receiving fewer customers, but the money that I earn has lost its value. I used to make 300 Afghanis per day, but nowadays I hardly can make 50, which is the price of 5 loaves of bread. Sometimes I feel ashamed when I look at my children.
In the meantime, widespread joblessness is leaving many Afghan families without a solution to make ends meet.
We have had a job once or twice a week in the spring and summer. I wonder why we should do it in the winter when there's no job to do. People are struggling with hunger and difficulties. Some have their own houses, but they should pay for the house rent too. This year, I fell short of paying the bills, and now I'm in debt.
This comes as the World Food Program has warned that Afghanistan is facing its most serious risk of famine in 20 years. The UN body has asked for $1.1 billion life-saving assistance for 18 million people across Afghanistan. The ripple effects of the U.S. sanctions and freezing of billions of dollars in Afghan assets are pushing up inflation in Afghanistan. People here are calling for the release of assets and more international funding to the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Polls show that a divided Congress appears all but assured 6 weeks before the federal legislative vote in the United States, which would also ensure continued political division and stagnation. The Democrat-led inquiry over protests which alleged election fraud in 2020 continue to plod on, but polls show they have had essentially no effect on changing voters' opinions. While longtime Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi looks certain to be forced out of power in November, the top level of Republican leadership looks likely to add more so-called Trumpists, reflecting the enduring influence of ex-President Donald Trump. The biggest unofficial political party in the United States is actually the self-declared independent voter. Polls indicate that a huge swing of 12% has taken place within this king-making group. In 2020, post-election polls found that they favored Democrats by 7%, but independents are now tilting towards Republicans by 5%.
Not happy with the way things are, obviously. We're all worried about inflation, and it's impacting our, you know, wallets. I wish there were more parties besides Republicans and Democrats, because it's just, you know, party interests, and people like you and me are just left behind. We have to live our lives, and politicians aren't really thinking about us.
Pollsters say the Democratic Party seems certain to lose control of the lower house of parliament, if not both houses. As the election nears, many expect the ongoing inflation and economic growth disasters caused by blowback from Western sanctions on Russia to play a larger and larger role in voters' decisions. A recent survey by Forbes found that 30% of Americans are drawing from their savings more than usual, which is the highest percentage in the survey's history. Another analysis found that the average American has lost over $4,000 in income since Joe Biden took office due to the increases in the inflation and interest rates. The midterms are on track to be the most expensive vote ever, reaching $10 billion by Election Day. Many say that's a reminder of the enormous role played in American democracy by money and advertising. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
The crisis hit Lebanon is once again a scene of angry masses. The parliament is back to meet and debate a new budget. Yet protesters see the budget being discussed as elusive.
Instead of putting together a budget which encourages development in agriculture, industrial production, and oil fields in Lebanon, they want to impoverish the people and push them to die in the sea as they immigrate illegally. The government, which relies on debt, is being controlled by a mob, which is the Banks Association and the Central Bank. They should be held accountable for getting billions of dollars out of the country.
Banks reopened partially on Monday following a week-long closure in the wake of a wave of holdups. Depositors stormed at least seven bank branches in the capital and abroad, demanding their trapped savings.
We know these banks, you know, where we invested our money. But unfortunately, they stole the money between themselves, and they plan, and every time they create a story.
One woman named Saleh Hafiz forced one branch to give her $13,000 of her savings, saying she needed it to pay for her sister's medical treatment. But she didn't take back her money on her own.
They left us no other choice. We encouraged Sally, and we were with her when she held up the bank, because it was a humanitarian situation, and we will be with all the people who urgently need their money. Our government is rotten and corrupt, and so is the judicial system.
A former member Member of Parliament tells Press TV that the government has been procrastinating while time is running out. The governmental institutions, including schools, are almost out of service.
The entire governmental sector is paralyzed. The workers, the military personnel, the ministerial workers, the public teachers, they all have rights and they can barely do their job. There's no health care, no educational assistance. The budget plan the parliament is debating today is unfair.
Lebanon's economic downfall began in October 2019. The Lebanese pound has lost around 90% of its value against the U.S. dollar, but officials have failed to put in place necessary reforms. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
From September 23rd to 27th, referendums on joining Russia were held in the Donetsk and Lugansk People's Republics, as well as the Zaporozhye and Kherson regions. Pro-Russian representatives of those regions say joining Russia will secure their territories and restore historical justice. They believe the move is vital in the face of what they call constant acts of terror by the nationalist authorities in Kyiv and NATO countries that supply weapons to Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin has backed the referendums, saying Moscow will support the decision made by the residents of the four regions.
Today, in the context of a special military operation and referendums in Donbas, saving people in all territories, namely saving people in all territories where this referendum is being held, is the main focus of Russia.
The referendum will determine the fate of 8 million people living in the LPR, the DPR, and the regions of Zaporozhye and Kherson.
People are tired and exhausted. They are being shelled and bombed every day. As a result, the residents of these republics ask authorities to hold referendums as soon as possible. Most of them have been supporting joining Russia since 2014. The second reason is the fear of any potential revenge by the Ukrainian regime.
Decisions of this kind and steps are always taken when the situation allows it. All the pros and cons are weighed. It has now become clear that the referendums are in line with the plans that the top leadership of Russia has. The future of Russia's constituent regions is complicated. Western countries will impose sanctions against their residents, like in the case of Crimea. Those regions were degraded under the Ukrainian leadership. Money was not invested in them at all. And now Russia is trying to ensure security and normal life in those territories.
Despite shelling of the territories where the secession referendums were held, the voter turnout was over 80% in all those regions. First partial results show that the overwhelming majority of the residents are in favor of joining Russia.
Most of the voters believe that if a state can join NATO despite Russia's opposition, then disputed Ukrainian regions can join Russia without the West's approval. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
As largely predicted by pollsters, the Brothers of Italy party has won the most votes in Italy's snap election, leading a right-wing coalition to victory. The turnout for the general election was about 64%, the lowest percentage ever recorded, around 9 points lower than the 73% turnout for the 2018 general election. Brothers of Italy, a group founded 10 years ago by its leader, Giorgia Meloni, grabbed more than 26% of the vote, while its allies, the League and the more moderate Silvio Berlusconi's Forza Italia, received respectively 9 and 8%. Meloni said on Monday that a future center-right government would not betray the trust of the Italian people.
Questo è il tempo della responsabilità.
This is a time for responsibility. This is a time in which, if you want to be part of history, you must realize that we have responsibility towards millions of people who chose us. We won't betray it, like we never have.
Meloni's flagship policies include defending traditional social values, anti-immigration programs, and the reduction of taxes. Meloni is slated to become the next prime minister, the first woman in Italy who has ever been appointed to that position. The news that a coalition led by Brothers of Italy won a decisive victory in Italy's snap elections has been welcomed by far-right parties from across Europe. The Brothers of Italy has relentlessly advocated for a free Europe, including sovereign countries, and promoted traditional values and essentialist conceptions of gender.
Certainly it won't be an easy task for Meloni to reassure the EU, other international partners and the moderate electorate, and at the same time maintain a strong connection with international populist groups and a more radical electorate. I don't think Meloni will ever find a way to mediate between these issues. That's why I believe her policies won't be too bold.
Among the defeated coalitions in Italy's national elections was the Democratic Party, growingly seen by a large number of Italians as the party of the establishment. Its leader, Enrico Letta, conceded defeat early on Monday, adding that his party would be the largest opposition force in the next parliament.
It is evident that mistakes were made. I will lead the next party until the next Congress, when a new leader will be determined.
According to the Italian constitution, newly elected members of the parliament must now meet within 20 days. The country's president, Sergio Mattarella, will begin consultations on who should be appointed as the new prime minister with the presidents of the Senate and Chamber of Deputies, the leaders of the main parties, and, at a later stage, with parliamentary groups. Max Civili, Rome.
The British pound takes a pounding yet again, only days after the country's finance minister announced the biggest tax-cutting package in decades, all funded by borrowing at a time of high inflation. They termed it a mini-budget, but it was a mega shift in direction. The Chancellor confirmed the government would implement Prime Minister Liz Truss's leadership campaign pledges to reverse the national insurance rise, cancel the corporation tax rise, and a surprise new tax cut for the highest earners.
Take the additional rate of income tax. At 45%, it is currently higher than the headline top rate in G7 countries like the US and Italy. And it is even higher than social democracies like Norway. But I'm not going to cut the additional rate of tax today, Mr. Speaker. I'm going to abolish it altogether.
Ordinary Britons may not think about exchange rates on a daily basis, but a fall in the pound will affect their day-to-day.
Britain imports nearly half of its foodstuffs, and therefore the pound gets weaker, the cost of that, those basic foodstuffs goes up dramatically. And so anything which is coming in will be hitting inflation at a time when you don't want to have that. The only good news part of actually of this will be actually your exports are now better value. The trouble is if the global demand is shrinking, therefore the demand for those exports would also be shrinking.
There are also concerns about a long recession as winter looms with no end in sight to the energy crisis or the war in Ukraine. Online calls for a general election are gaining traction. And in the Conservative Party itself, rumors about a no-confidence vote in the brand new prime minister.
Some experts say the UK's central bank, the Bank of England, could intervene to halt the pound sliding. Many others are saying the government's decision to borrow its way out of the current situation could end in tears. Saeed Burizap, London.
The crisis hit Lebanon is once again a scene of angry masses. The parliament is back to meet and debate a new budget. Yet protesters see the budget being discussed as elusive.
Instead of putting together a budget which encourages development in agriculture, industrial production, and oil fields in Lebanon, they want to impoverish the people and push them to die in the sea as they immigrate illegally. The government, which relies on debt, is being controlled by a mob, which is the Banks Association and the Central Bank. They should be held accountable for getting billions of dollars out of the country.
Banks reopened partially on Monday following a week-long closure in the wake of a wave of holdups. Depositors stormed at least 7 bank branches in the capital and abroad demanding their trapped savings.
We know these banks, you know, where we invested our money. But unfortunately, they stole the money between themselves, and they plan, and every time they create a story.
One woman named Sally Hafez forced one branch to give her $13,000 of her savings, saying she needed it to pay for her sister's medical treatment. But she didn't take back her money on her own.
They left us no other choice. We encouraged Sally, and we were with her when she held up the bank, because it was a humanitarian situation, and we will be with all the people who urgently need their money. Our government is rotten and corrupt, and so is the judicial system.
The government has been procrastinating while time is running out. The governmental institutions, including schools, are almost out of service.
The entire governmental sector is paralyzed. The workers, the military personnel, the ministerial workers, the public teachers, they all have rights and they can barely do their job. There's no health care, no educational assistance. The budget plan the parliament is debating today is unfair.
Lebanon's economic downfall began in October 2019. The Lebanese pound has lost around 90% of its value against the U.S. dollar, but officials have failed to put in place necessary reforms. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In a situation where the Biden administration's comprehensive support for Ukraine against Russia continues, the result of the latest opinion polls indicate a decrease in the support of the American public for these aids. The recent opinion polls show that almost half of the American public are against their country's arms assistance to Ukraine. Economic experts say U.S. arms aid to Ukraine continues at a time when most of the American public are facing poverty, high consumer prices, unprecedented inflation, and livelihood problems. Some political analysts also say that by sending huge cargoes of arms and weaponry to Ukraine, in fact, the United States and Britain want to test the effectiveness of their weapons. We have taken a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Russia Today tells us more about this story. The Pentagon issued a list of American military aid approved for Ukraine so far this year, outlining nearly $17 billion in arms sales and military weapons, including tens of thousands of anti-tank systems, just shy of 1 million artillery rounds, and an array of heavy and long-range weapons platforms. A fact sheet on U.S. security assistance to Ukraine released by the Pentagon recently notes that Washington has authorized $16.9 billion worth in military aid for Kiev in 2022, the vast majority of which came after Moscow started its special operation in the neighboring country in February. The list includes more than 1,400 Stinger anti-aircraft systems, over 8,500 Javelin anti-tank weapons, and 32,000 other anti-armor platforms, as well as some 988,000 howitzer rounds, 60 million rounds of small arms ammunition, and tens of thousands of mortars, rockets, and grenades. The Pentagon has also sent large quantities of heavy weaponry, among them over 150 artillery pieces, 20 Mi-17 helicopters, 200 M113 armored personnel carriers, hundreds of Humvees, and 16 high-mobility artillery rocket systems, or HIMARS, one of the longest-range platforms provided by Washington to date, in addition to non-lethal gear such as helmets, body armor, and mine-clearing equipment. The U.S. supplied Ukraine with at least 700 Switchblade suicide drones and an undisclosed number of Claymore anti-personnel mines. In its latest $1.1 billion aid package for Kiev, announced on Wednesday, 28th of September, the U.S. Defense Department vowed to more than double the number of HIMARS units operated by the Ukrainian military, seeking to send another 18 on top of the 16 already authorized. However, officials noted it could take a few years before the rocket systems are ready for the battlefield, as they will not be pulled from existing U.S. stocks, but rather contracted to American arms manufacturers. A senior Pentagon official told reporters the HIMARS are intended to serve as a core component of Ukraine's fighting force in the future, explaining that it is a sizable investment designed to prepare Kiev for the long haul. The apparent shift to a longer-term approach comes as some military experts warn that Washington will not be able to keep up the pace of security assistance set over the last 6 months, with CNBC noting mounting problems in the American weapons supply chain in a recent report. Russia's RIA Novosti news agency explains more about the same story. A new opinion poll conducted by the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft revealed nearly half of the American public are against sending military aid to Ukraine if the U.S. is not involved in diplomatic efforts to resolve the conflict. The opinion poll showed on Tuesday, 27th of September, almost half of the respondents, or 47%, said they only support the continuation of U.S. military aid to Ukraine if Washington is involved in ongoing diplomacy. About 40% of those who took part in the opinion poll expressed their support for providing weapons to Kiev, regardless of the negotiation process. Roughly 58% said they would oppose the U.S. providing military aid to Ukraine at current levels if their own country suffers higher gas prices and a higher cost of goods. The opinion poll also revealed that 57% of likely voters support the U.S. pursuing diplomatic negotiations as soon as possible to end the conflict, while only 32% oppose such efforts. Executive Vice President at the Quincy Institute, Trita Parsi, was quoted as saying in the release, "Americans recognize what many in Washington don't. Russia's special operation in Ukraine is more likely to end at the negotiating table than on the battlefield, and there is a brewing skepticism of Washington's approach to this war, which has been heavy on tough talk and military aid, but light on diplomatic strategy and on engagement." 6% of those surveyed further recognized that Russia's special military operation is among the top issues the U.S. is currently facing. Other concerns included inflation, gun violence in the United States, and the state of the U.S. economy. TASS news agency covers the same story but from a different angle. Head of the Russian delegation at the Vienna talks on military security and arms control, Konstantin Gavrilov, says the United States views the world as a range to test its weapons. Gavrilov made the statement in a speech at the plenary session of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe Forum for Security Cooperation. He was quoted as saying in a speech published by the Russian Foreign Ministry, he said, "It has long been clear that Kiev's handlers in Washington view the whole world as a large testing ground and use any armed conflict, even if they are not directly involved in it, to test the effectiveness of their weapons." Konstantin Gavrilov said, according to a report by the Congressional Research Service on U.S. wars and military interventions around the world, since 1798, Washington has unleashed 469 wars and military interventions around the world. The Russian diplomat continued by saying, U.S. Professor J.S. Miller-Lucas concluded the U.S. wars since the Second World War have claimed an estimated 25 million lives with impunity. But Washington has no intention to stop. The diplomat noted U.S.-made weapons continue to be tested on civilians with the help of Ukrainian troops and radicals. He underlined, the Ukrainian Defense Ministry has openly invited companies of the United States military-industrial complex to test pilot projects before mass production, which will allegedly increase the competitiveness of these weapons if they are tested in a combat zone. Well, that's not new, of course. The international community remembers well how, in August of 1945, the United States tested nuclear weapons on civilians in the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Today, we are talking about the actual legalization at the government level of the use of Ukrainian troops and civilians, who will be the targets of these weapons as cannon fodder. Konstantin Gavrilov said Moscow is warning Washington and London against reckless moves that could push the situation around Ukraine to a dangerous point.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdy. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight, a turning point in the months-long war between Russia and Ukraine. Russian President Vladimir Putin has signed the treaties on the accession of four Ukrainian regions. This follows referendums recently held in Kherson, Zaporizhia, Donetsk, and Luhansk, where people voted overwhelmingly to join Russia, a vote as expected not recognized by Ukraine and its Western allies. Kiev was quick to respond to Moscow's proclamation by announcing its application for accelerated membership in the Western Military Alliance, NATO. In this edition of Spotlight, we'll discuss what this move means for the Russia-Ukraine conflict and how it affects the growing tensions between Moscow and the West. Joining us on tonight's show, we have journalist, activist, and political analyst John Bosnich joining us from Belgrade. And contributor at the Schiller Institute, Carol Varekin, joining us from the French capital, Paris.
This is the Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Bosnich in Belgrade. Russia says that people in the four regions have voted overwhelmingly to join the Russian Federation. Ukraine and its Western allies, including the EU and the U.S., have called the referendums illegal and a sham. I want you to give us your perspective on the referendums and their ratifications by Moscow.
Well, first of all, this is just effectively a fait accompli
the accession of these territories to the Russian Federation was achieved by military means, but the important thing is that the people in those regions are fully in support of joining Russia and becoming members and citizens of Russia. The condemnation from the West is typical because they speak one thing and do another. If we talk about the United States itself, the entire country of the United States was stolen from its original inhabitants, and referenda were never used to take over territory. They simply stole it or took it by force of arms. And for the United States to be condemning Russia's efforts to involve the people in each of these decisions is simply not believable and not credible.
Let's cross over to our guest in Paris, Mr. Varikhan. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has described Russia's incorporation of the territories as a, quote, dangerous escalation and an illegal violation of the UN Charter. Talk to us about the legality of the move and also touch up on the issue, as our guest in Belgrade did, as to why these regions have voted in favor of joining Russia so overwhelmingly.
Well, the Western narrative is increasingly Orwellian, and where peace is war and the world is upside down, because the nuance, the differentiation, which is really has to be made, is the difference between international order based on rules written exclusively by the West, and then on the other side, the international law as it was defined by the Charter of both the Atlantic Charter in 1941 and by the United Nations, which includes the self-determinations of people to know where what what kind of self-governance they want. So since this war has started in 2014, and that people in Kiev have been denying not only the Russian speakers but also the Hungarian speakers to use their own language to manage their affairs, many of these Russian-speaking people in southern and eastern Ukraine, of course, felt like kicked out of their own country and are fully quite happy that they can be part of the Russian Federation. What I am really shocked with is the fact that there is apparently there were a kind at least over 100 of observers from foreign countries, including from South Africa, France, and other countries. And these observers, nobody is interviewing them. I got a report from a French observer who said it was just normal, and that contrary to that Mr. Blinken was saying, this is not on gunpoint people pushed to vote. These are people happy to vote and finally relieved that they can now think about a better future.
John Wozniak, what does this accession by Russia mean overall for the conflict itself? How will this change the situation on the ground, in your opinion?
Oh, this is, in fact, a night and day change in the situation. Now that these territories have declared for membership in the Russian Federation and the president has signed a decree accepting their application, once the legal formalities are completed and the state declarations are circulated, then any attack by Ukrainian forces on these territories constitutes, at least in the eyes of Russia and its allies and the many other countries around the world that recognize the procedure of referenda, it constitutes an act of war against Russia proper. This could explain why President Putin called up so many reservists, because if Ukraine wants to attack Russia, then Russia will, of course, have to defend itself. And the result of Russia itself having to defend itself against Ukraine will mean a totally new phase in the war and could bring down the entire Ukraine regime in Kiev. That's really playing with fire. But of course, the decision is not being made by the marionette president that the United States put in power there, Mr. Zelensky, but it is being made in NATO headquarters, where they're trying to gauge how much further they can push this conflict, how many more weapons they can circulate, and how much more they can dominate the European allies of America ever since World War II. This is really a turning point where we see whether NATO cracks or whether NATO continues to oppress the entire region. This is the day.
Mr. Varykhan, Ukraine says now that it's applying for fast-track NATO membership following Moscow's formal integration of those four Ukrainian regions into Russia. I want to get your thoughts on this issue itself, whether it will be heeded by NATO at this point, and what kind of a response are you expecting to see from the likes of the U.S. and the EU and possibly the United Nations?
Well, I just watched the press conference of Mr. Stoltenberg in Brussels, and the most scary thing about this whole press conference is that he qualified the integration of these four regions as the most serious escalations since the beginning of the conflict. So instead of learning the lesson that this war is unwinnable and that the West should stop using the Ukrainians as cannon fodder, they keep insisting that this is all that the Russians are the aggressor, and that we cannot sign peace, and that the West is supposed to fight to liberate these four regions, including Crimea, which is a special case, and which is even most any professional diplomat would take out the Crimea issue out of the current ceasefire negotiation because it's a very complicated issue. So the most scary thing is on the one side the blind attitude of NATO, and I would say on the other side the new element, which has been the sabotage of the gas pipelines close to Denmark.
John Bosnich, I want you to address that issue as well. In terms of responses, U.S. President Joe Biden said Washington will never recognize what he called Russia's annexation of Ukrainian land. The European Union has vowed to never recognize the absorption, accused the Kremlin of jeopardizing global security. Give us your thoughts on the reactions and responses that we'll be seeing from NATO countries, from the United States, maybe even the U.N.
Well, when a political leader says they will never recognize an act, that's a diplomatic code for impotence. It means that we can't do anything about it. We realize that we can't reverse it. But at least on paper, we're going to say we don't recognize it. This is effectively a day of victory for Russia. And I would also dispute Mr. Stoltenberg's comment about this being a critical increase in the crisis. In fact, what has happened here is the crisis is winding down because Russia has declared the inclusion of these territories into Russia proper, and this means that NATO now has to make a choice which they simply don't have the guts to make, which is to make war on Russia proper. They thought that they could twist arms, they thought that they could continue to pull strings and continue to do what they do best. Because what NATO does best is not fight wars, but sell weapons. Mr. Stoltenberg is probably on a percentage cut for weapons sales, and that's where he makes his money. And that's the same with many of the leaders in the NATO countries. Their job is to sell weapons, to sell fear, and to get their taxpayers to continue dishing out to a military-industrial complex that not only runs the wars, but it bribes the politicians and runs the Western world. This conflict in Ukraine is not just a turning point locally in Ukraine. It's a global turning point that the world is saying, not just Russia, but the world is saying, don't do it anymore. We've had enough. And that is significantly visible when you see that the entire rest of the world, the countries that are not military colonies of the United States inside NATO, the entire rest of the world is united against this NATO incursion into the back doorstep of Russia.
Mr. Varykhan, in recent days, multiple gas leaks have been discovered in the Nord Stream pipelines running from Russia to Europe. Vladimir Putin earlier accused the U.S. and its allies of sabotaging the pipelines. He said, quote, "The sanctions were not enough for the Anglo-Saxons, so they moved on to sabotage," and he added, "it's clear to everyone who benefits from this." Who will benefit from such a scenario?
Well, of course, the first benefiter will be some of the Polish stooges, because they have created this new Baltic pipeline to get gas from Norway into Europe. So, I mean, we should, of course, the investigation will have to bring up new elements, but it is, this thing is really incredible, because first of all, the Baltic Sea is completely controlled by NATO. There were recent maneuvers, including on underwater drones, and even if they recognized that this was done by the Russians, it would be, a total failure. Secondly, there were all the warnings from Mr. Bolton, from Mike Pompeo to Condoleezza Rice to Biden himself on February 7, where he said they would never tolerate that the Nord Stream 2 pipeline would exist, because it would create a more integrated cooperation between Germany and Russia. Now the big Russia is losing, and maybe the pipelines will be definitely become unusable, because the seawater creates a lot of corrosion inside the pipes, and it will be very hard to repair them. But in this way, I mean, many people in Eastern Europe, in the Czech Republic, there were huge demonstrations in favor of trying to push the governments of Germany and others to open the Nord Stream pipelines and to come to a kind of deal and work out outside or get rid of the sanctions, because the winter is here arriving in Europe, and many people don't want to freeze. We want peace. We want to settle this question in a rational manner. And the big winner, the big loser in any case, is Europe. And that's the new game changer, because if the United States and the forces behind NATO or the military industrial complex, if they start attacking the infrastructure inside the European Union, this is an entire new dimension of this global war.
John Bosnich, Russia has time and again said countries supplying weapons to Ukraine and training its soldiers were in fact parties to the conflict. The question is, will this support ultimately result in this conflict spilling over into other regions and possibly turning into something bigger?
That's always a possibility if the conflict gets out of control. But it is not in the interest of any of the parties, including Ukraine, except perhaps for the joker president whose stay in power depends on the war continuing. What we've got here is a lateral expansion of the war into European territory. The attack on the pipeline, most likely done by England or America because they have the tools and the capacity to do it, is actually a militarized attack on the EU by non-EU members, England and America. Now, yes, the leaders of the EU are largely puppets of America and of England, and these puppets will not object, but the citizens of Europe should at some point be raising their heads up and saying, why are we putting up with this? Why are we continuing to elect leaders who do whatever they're ordered to do from Washington? So I would suggest that although there is a temporary setback in terms of cooperation between Russia and Germany, which is inevitable, that they will cooperate in the future, the temporary setback is pointing the finger at England and the United States, thereby distancing the people of Germany and the people of Europe from the Anglo-American Empire, which, if anything results from this war, the best thing that could result is that Europe becomes an independent territory again, no longer under Anglo-American foreign control.
Over to our guest in Paris, we're talking about the support that the United States and NATO has been giving to Ukraine. Is this support ultimately what the U.S. and NATO wants, is the conflict to be prolonged and to see it dragged out for as long as possible in hopes that it weakens Russia? I want to get your perspective on that and whether they've been successful, in your opinion.
Well, at the press conference, Mr. Stoltenberg, because the question was asked by a Ukrainian journalist if they would get the right for a fast track to enter into NATO, and Mr. Stoltenberg was very evasive and not saying that this the doors are still open, but right now the issue is, as you say, just to give the means to Ukraine to defend its and to reconquer its territory. Now, on the ground, there were recent reports that even the U.S., you know, the 155-millimeter cannons, ammunition, they're running out of ammunition. They are not producing the ammunition which is required on a daily basis by the Ukrainian army. So from that standpoint, you know, there are skirmishes and things still going on the borders of these of these four provinces. But basically, the West, I mean, the West has been destroying its own industrial base, including to produce some of these ammunition, which is not arriving. And therefore, this whole idea that there is a big Ukrainian offensive now, it's somehow a big joke. And I think the attack on the pipeline shows that from the West, they are really desperate on the underground situation.
And one last question for you, Mr. Varekin. This is an issue that Mr. Bosnich just mentioned moments ago about the purpose of NATO. I want to get your perspective as well. Why did NATO continue to exist following the collapse of the Soviet Union and at the end of the Cold War? What is the purpose of NATO today as we speak?
Well, the purpose of NATO during its creation, as there was one British lawyer who said, was the purpose was to keep the Russians out, the Americans in, which means in Europe, and the Germans down. That was the initial purpose of NATO. Today, I agree with, there was a British professor who said that the only purpose of NATO now is to manage the problems and the conflicts they are creating themselves. So we should put, and with my friend Mr. Cheminade in France, we're calling, and many other candidates have been calling, that France should do like the Gaulle and leave the integrated command of NATO, that we need a new international security order and financial order.
Okay.
That this thing is completely prehistorical barbarism. We should get rid of it.
All right. Thanks a lot, gentlemen. That's all the time we have for tonight's show. John Bosnich, journalist, activist, and political analyst, joining us from Belgrade. And Carol Varekin, contributor at the Schiller Institute, speaking to us from the French capital, Paris. And, of course, a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight.